Yeah, I just wanted to talk a little bit about Canada's colonialist approach to indigenous peoples in this country. What I want to talk about is mostly the current situations in my community of Gunasadage, using that as an example to look at other communities and the system that's being imposed on the communities. So in Gunasadage, what we have is a system of government which exists across the board in Canada amongst what they call Indians, mostly the indigenous population of the south, and amongst the Inuit, they have similar types of government. The type of government they've imposed on us is underneath the Indian Act, which is a system of government that was introduced by the British colonial government, and is the same type of government that they imposed on the South African indigenous population called apartheid. Although they try to convince the so-called indigenous leaders that this government is for their benefit and it's for the betterment of the communities, in fact, a method of control in the native communities. And a fine example of this was what happened on January 12th. I hope everybody's aware of what happened January 12th in Gunasadage with the legal police intervention and the subsequent burning of James Gabriel's residence. This is a direct symptom of the sickness that was fostered by the Indian Act, a system of government that's an adversarial government that continually keeps the community in perpetual fighting and keeps people vying for that position of power. I equate it to a dog chasing its own tail. You know, the mouth is chasing the tail, and the mouth is blaming the tail for all the problems, yet it doesn't realize that it's part of the same dog. This is where a lot of the problems lie. In 1924, in Oswego, which is known as Six Nations, near the Hamilton area, between Hamilton and Brantford, there was a traditionalist government that was there that existed since the War of 1776, since the American War of Independence, when New York State was ethnically cleansed of the Iroquois inhabitants, who were forced to flee into southern Ontario. And they brought with them their system of government, which was a participatory democracy where everybody had an equal voice. This government was running up until 1924, when the Canadian government, under Duncan Campbell Scott, who was also one of the progenitors of the apartheid system, he shared his ideas with the South African government, decided that they're going to impose an elective system in Oswego. What they did is they initially went in, they arrested the entire council, and they seized what they figured was sacred objects, namely wampum belts and wampum strings, headdresses, mnemonic canes. We had talking sticks that would have the whole history of the founding of the Confederacy on it, so that a speaker could remember this. They figured that if they took these symbols, they would be able to destroy what existed as part of the indigenous government. Well, it failed. It still exists. Anyways, they did this, and they went further. They imposed elective council, and they installed them in the same council house that was housing this traditionalist council. They went on to Akwesasne and imposed the same system, but this time they used a lot more force. They killed Jake Fire. The RCMP killed Jake Fire in Cornwall Island, and they imposed the elective system there. They went to every Gunyokahaga and Rodinusuni community and imposed the same system within these communities, the band council system, so effectively removing the voice of the people and installing a singular voice of a male representative in the community. For people who are not knowledgeable about what Iroquoian government is primarily egalitarian as far as gender is concerned. You have female representatives and male representatives on an equal footing. Secondly, it is a true participatory democracy in that there is no single leader. The people use their voice to air their opinions, and it's a consensus government. This is something that's lacking in the Canadian system, in the European system, that is a very hierarchical system, whereas you have a leader and everybody else under the leader who are less important. It's not by chance that they disallowed the traditionalist system to exist in our communities. This is the process of their colonialization, that they wanted to create a system where they could keep one leader and manipulate this leader, line this leader's pockets with money, and keep them in luxury. When they got out of line, they would threaten them with removing that luxurious life from under them. and it's been very effective. This is something I believe, I'm assuming, and also from things I've seen, that is done across the board in a lot of like minority communities and in poor communities. I think one of the closest parallels I've been drawing as of late is like the Palestinian Authority and the way they operate. Like basically everybody's starving and they're driving around with their Mercedes Benzes. We have the same situation in Ganasadage and in Gracinaos, I'm sure, in other communities. The system exists across the board. And like I said, it's deliberate to keep people in disarray. Getting back to what happened in Ganasadage on January the 12th, over the years, there's been a great deal of discord. I mean, it can go back hundreds of years, but just to recap the last 120 years, in the 1820s, there was a discord between the village of Oka, the French community in Oka, but mostly the church, the power structure, the Sulpician order in the village of Oka. And there was, the issue at hand was land again and resources. Whereas people in Ganasadage were not allowed to do anything on their land without the permission of the church. And at a protest, a good portion of the community converted to Methodism, which was a very big slap in the face of the Catholic Church. They all turned into Protestants out of protest. So they built the church, and then the Sulpicians went and tore the church down once it was built. And in turn, there was a little bit of quid pro quo amongst the groups. Some Ganasadake Rono went and burnt down the Catholic Church. And this sparked the first official Oka crisis. Whereas I think it was about maybe 300 at the time were called Quebec Provincial Police, NRCMP, who raided the community and occupied it for the entire summer of 1884. They tried subsequently to try and convict leaders in the community of arson, and they failed. They went to different municipalities. Every time they would get a not guilty verdict or a hung jury, go to different communities. So they ended up in Hull, and everything ended in Hull. To bring us up to more recent times, in the 1950s, a developer from Belgium suddenly acquired land in what we call Onondaga, or the Pines, the famous Pines from 1990. And he sold it to the municipality of Oka. And the municipality of Oka established a private 9-hole golf course. Private in that the poor people in Oka, the poor French people in Oka, weren't even allowed to have access to this. This is reserved for the rich people in Hudson, the rich people from Montreal, and the rich people from the other surrounding communities to be members, to pay the private memberships to join this golf club. But the problem was that they built this golf club on the pasture land that the farmers that were living in Ganasadage, the indigenous farmers, were using for pasture, using as a common ground for gatherings and so on. So they built this golf course, and also was a burial area. So they built this golf course, and they surrounded the burial area with their driveway and their parking lot. And people protested, and again, they sent in their heavy-handed police forces to crush this revolt. And at the time, the band councils were still being run by Indian agents that were non-native representatives sent from Ottawa to administer whatever law and order that they see fit to administer against the community. Coming to 1990, just before us, in 1985, plans surfaced of a plan to expand the golf course development into 18 holes to exhume the 300-year-old cemetery that we've been burying our people in and put them in a common grave and make a parking lot. So basically people decided that they're not going to take this, and we occupied the forest. And eventually the municipality of Oka obtained junctions, and what followed was a conflict where the Sûreté de Québec, who have been renowned for their heavy-handed tactics against indigenous communities across Quebec, Restigouche 1981 over salmon rights, busting heads and actually urinating on children at one point in that confrontation, use of machine guns, tear gas, truncheons, and so on. And then again in Rapid Lake in Parc La Vérendrye, amongst the Algonquin over there, over logging. Over there they were protesting the clear cutting by Domtar of Parc La Vérendrye and their hunting territory. Again, tear gas, truncheons, and so on. And in Ganasadage, over successive years, different interventions to go against what they supposedly entitle illegal commerce of any type, one such intervention was against somebody who was selling firecrackers, so they sent in the SWAT team to seize firecrackers. And then again in 1989, they sent in another force to crack down on illegal gambling and bingo. So it's illegal as long as natives do it, but as soon as a lot of Quebec does it, it becomes legal. This is basically the message that they're sending. So in 1990, it was a peaceful occupation, and what they did is they sent in their troops in May, but we May of 1990, and we were able to avert any type of confrontation. But we knew something was happening, so we invited our sister communities of Akwesasne and Ganawage to send people down and to bring some arms, because we were afraid that we weren't going to stand by and have them beat us down again. So people brought arms as a precaution. You know, July 11th could have been a lot worse, but what was fortunate is that we told ourselves that we were going to use the Rutinoses Haga system, the traditionalist system of government, that is the egalitarian system. And the women actually were able to reel in some of the more testosterone-driven men who wanted to go, you know, like, we want to do some, we're going to bust some heads. So they prevented a lot of the violence. This is where the clash of cultures begins. Basically, when the police showed up on that day, they didn't understand that these women were going to negotiate with the police, and then right away it was like, well, where are your leaders? And implying that they wanted the male leaders, and the women saying, well, we are the leaders, we are the representatives of the community, which is something that was totally foreign to them. It was foreign in the 1600s and still foreign to them today, the whole concept that this is part of the governing body. And then the media, again, Journal de Montréal in particular, Les guerrières cachent à l'arrière des femmes, you know, the warriors are hiding behind the women, and so on, without any idea of how we run our system and how we look at ourselves and how we identify and what we use as a system of government, a governance. Again, a whole patriarchal idea of what constitutes authority and what should constitute authority. After that confrontation, you know, everything exploded into what we had as the 1990 Oka crisis. And again, the governments used the whole divide and conquer tactic, whereas they had a band council system that was imposed in the 1970s with elected councils, but they used a bastardized version of the traditional clan system to have these representatives, and they put it under the guise of custom. But in reality, these people were just, again, a whole set of leaders, male leaders, again, single leaders, who they recognize as the representatives of the community to sign agreements and so on. During 1990, they started using these people to feed them money and have them sell information to the police, the CSIS, and so on, about what's going on in the community. And what came out of that is that in 1991, we were able to, as a community, well, part of the community, fought to have an elective system imposed into the community instead of having the twisted Indian Act version of the traditional government system. They put an elective system, which is a part of the options in the Indian Act. So they had this elective system, and at around the same time, in other communities, there was a great deal of conflict with people who were living outside the community, like living in urban centers and everything, as far as voting rights are concerned. So there was a court case. Can't cite the exact name of the people involved in the court case, but they won a court case forcing band councils to recognize outside native people living on the outside as having a right to vote in band council elections. Now, to put it maybe in a context that you might understand a little clearer, it's like saying you live in Montreal, but you're originally from Quebec City, but you're living in Montreal and you're allowed to vote in Quebec City still. So this is what's happening now. And then immediately following 1990, a lot of criminal elements did get attracted to Ganasadage. There was a sense of lawlessness. There was a kind of a free-for-all, and people kind of tended to believe that they can do whatever they want. So then we attracted some of the more likable characters in Quebec, you know, the Hells Angels and the organized crime figures, who did come to the community. But they were short-lived. Eventually, they did leave because basically the community doesn't want this type of thing in its midst. At the same time, there was the big debacle with the planting of fields of marijuana. And James Gabriel is at this time comes to the forefront as the Elliot Ness character, going on about like how this is wrong and that the elective councils at the time were in cahoots with the criminals implanting this marijuana. I mean, it was a handful of people who did this in the community. And in fact, James Gabriel plowed the fields for them to plant the marijuana, and which is something he doesn't want you to know. But he got paid to plow the fields so they can plant all this weed. But what's the real issue here is not so much the weed and so on. There's an issue of poverty. And you have to understand that these band councils, as I said before, are not a beneficial system for the community. Basically, these people hold the purse strings. They hold the monopoly on economics. They hold the monopoly on power. They hold the monopoly of violence by way of controlling police forces. 95% of the people, or more in some communities, sometimes 100% of the people, are employed by band councils in the communities. And how it's run through nepotism, it's run through patronage, and so on. And the system is designed to do this, to create this atmosphere in the community, whereas the system of government we had traditionally would not allow that type of thing to happen, because you can't isolate a leader in traditional government, in participatory democracy. You can't isolate one leader to meter out some special treatment over other people in the community. He's still accountable for the people, but under the Indian Act Band Council system, they're not accountable to anybody. Basically, they can do whatever they want. Now, there's a big uproar in the mainstream media about this sponsorship scandal. What about the sponsorship scandal, the Canadian colonial sponsorship scandal in Indian country? What about that scandal? What about the scandal of higher suicide rates? What about the scandal of largest prison population per capita compared to the non-native population? What about the scandal of the drug addiction and the homelessness, where the indigenous people, there's no reason why indigenous people should be homeless? This is a preposterous notion to me. We're living in the supposed richest area of the world, supposedly Canada, supposedly the best place in the world to live, yet we have native people right here in Montreal living in Cabot Park, near Atwater and St. Catherine. This is unjustifiable. This is genocide. This is ethnocide. Because not only did they impose these systems on us, they also imposed education systems on us. The education systems that stripped away our traditional knowledge and our language. See, language and knowledge and ecology all go in together. When you have your language and you have your knowledge of your traditions and you have your knowledge of your environment, then everything works in order. Everything works the way it should work. So this is where the ethnocide begins, when they start tearing away that language and start imposing their own system of language and their own system of religion, and they commodify everything that was once alive, becomes a commodity through the stripping away of their culture and their language. This is something that's seen throughout North and South America, Australia, and Africa. You have these killer cultures and killer languages going and totally destroying indigenous cultures across the board. So getting on again with the band council system and its ramifications. So after the planting of the marijuana and the subsequent media circus that followed, whereas Serge Menard, the public security minister, came down to Kanasadage with some representative from the council, and a big show of force, went there, the work gloves, and tore all the marijuana plants and tore them into trucks and helicopters flying overhead and squad cars going up and down the road and so on and so forth. And Kanasadage became known as Cannabisatage, according to the Journal de Montréal. And instead of addressing the poverty and the issues of this adversarial band council system, all that was seen as Les Hells, the Hells Angels, and the Mafia in Kanasadage. And no talk about the lack of employment. You have almost an 80% unemployment rate in Native communities. You can't get a job unless you have a family member on council, and a lot of times you can't get anything going unless you have some kind of a paternalistic relationship with somebody in council. And the louder you talk, the less you get. This is, everything's controlled by the Indian Act in these communities, in our communities. Even when you die, it's controlled by the Indian Act. Basically you're not considered dead till Ottawa says you're dead. Things like this. This system of government has not done any service to our communities. I admit there are leaders that attempt to make change, to affect change in the communities, where they go into the communities and they try hard, but eventually they will be put down to the level that the government wants them, or they'll be put into perpetual litigation until they want to leave. This is what's happening now in Ganasadage. Basically, the people have no say, and they have leaders like who we have now, who are saying to people that, listen, you know, like I'm the leader, I'm the ruler around here. I'll make the decisions. Traditional government's a fairy tale. Consensus government will never work. And this is things that these people are saying in public, because they know that Ottawa is always going to recognize them, because there's legitimate public popular government that is supported by the people, you know, to crib the American Constitution, which was stolen from us anyway, by the people for the people. This kind of government is never recognized because they can't corrupt this kind of government. They can't corrupt the entire population. They can corrupt a couple of the leaders, but they can't corrupt the entire population. So coming to what happened on January 12th of this year, again, the elections are coming up in July, and so we use a heavy-handed police action, criminalized the entire community with the full support of the Solicitor General. There's no money for education, no money for healthcare, and no money for infrastructure, even though they impose infrastructure on us in a way to municipalize the community. But then they say there's no money. But strangely, there's $900,000 for policing. There's $900,000 to come in and arrest people, to bust heads, to shoot people. These people, they label as criminals in the community. You know, they want to go in and they want to go in heavy-handedly and, you know, bring in their assault rifles and so on and shoot it up. Yeehaw, let's go. You know, like, people fail to realize that these people they're going after, even though they may not like what they're doing for a living. Yeah, okay, there's some people dealing drugs in the community, but they have families with them too. They have children in their houses. And going in there fully armed to the teeth and shooting it out is not going to be any solution. And these people will go to prison eventually, but then they will come out. And I've never known any prisoner to go in and come out a better person. So this is no solution to our dilemma in Ganasadage. The only solution I see is that we are allowed to have our own say, our own decision-making, without any influences from the government of Canada or the government of Quebec, without them going around saying they recognize or not recognize who's in power and who's not in power and so on and so forth. Time to get their noses out of the business of the community. And it's time for the community, along with the activist community, to stand up and effect some change in these communities and in your own community. Because basically, we're all victims of the same system. 21 again for now.